I call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Gilman, would you like to move the minutes from February 20th?
Sure, so moved. I'll move the minutes.
Representative Gilman moves the minutes for February 20th, 2024. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Ayes have it. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have a full house again today, and four bills on the agenda. We are going to go in the order of the two Purcell, Representative Purcell bills, then the Bowser bill, and then Representative Jordan's bill. So first up is House File 3389, Representative Purcell, subsurface drain tile installation and modification reporting required. Representative Purcell, would you like to move that House File 3389 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's my motion.
And Representative Purcell, I believe you have a DE1 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it briefly?
So moved.
Representative Purcell moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. Please describe the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 3389, as amended, is one step to create accountability and transparency for the future generations of Minnesotans who grow our food, fuel, fiber, and flowers all across our state. There have been decades of unregulated and unreported tiling of thousands of agricultural acres each year, which speeds the rate of rainwater or meltwater that runs off the land and into ditches, creeks, lakes, and streams, increasing flooding on farms, washing out of culverts, changing water flow in public drainage ditches, and contributing to increased flooding in communities downstream. Today, there's no public record of where tile has been installed. There may be no way to know the condition, age, or even the existence of drain tile on farmed acres. When my family moved to Northfield and rented land to farm, we learned after a season or two that the field we had been growing on was tiled. Not by a previous landowner, but a longtime renter of that field by a neighboring farmer. Luckily, that neighbor casually dropped into conversation one day mid-season that he had altered the water course on that particular area a while back. But we had no records to confer what year it was installed, and he couldn't remember off the top of his head. With that information, perhaps we would have altered our growing and watering practices had we had that information before sowing one seed in the ground. The original language of the bill put the onus on SWCD's Soil and Water Conservation Districts to collect the information on tiling, and after many conversations, I've made the decision to have the DE amendment to change it so it is another disclosure on agricultural real property transfers, just like wells and septic systems are required to be disclosed at the point of sale. The more information a new landowner has about their land, the better they'll be able to manage their soil, water, and business. And I want future farmers of Minnesota to have as much information to make the best decisions for managing their land as they're able. Thank you, and I'd be happy to stand for questions, and there are testifiers.
So Representative Purcell, we actually have to vote on the DE1 amendment. So
that's
right. Any discussion to the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Ayes have it. The DE1 amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended, we have a couple testifiers first before we go into discussion. Amanda Bilek, Minnesota Corn Growers Association. So just before any of the testimony starts, we're going to give about 2 minutes for every person. This goes throughout the hearing. And I will lightly tap the gavel when 2 minutes are up. So, please proceed.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Amanda Bilek. I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Our association represents about 7,000 Minnesota corn family farmers. Appreciate being here today to testify on House File 3389 as amended. Earlier, after the bill was introduced, the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, and Minnesota Farmers Union met with Representative Purcell to discuss some of our concerns with the bill as it was originally introduced. We appreciate the author's willingness to work with us and bring forward the author's amendment that really models this after the current well disclosure process for real estate transactions. Agricultural drainage is incredibly important to Minnesota's farmers. Some of the benefits of drainage is that it can improve the timeliness of field operations, such as planting the crop. And especially in northern climates where we have a shorter growing season, there's a small window to get that crop in the ground. And the Minnesota also has some different soil textures that can limit some of that water infiltration based upon soil type in different parts of the state. So early in season rain events can add some challenges to that short planting window for getting that crop established. And drain tile can help to improve that situation and provide a little more certainty. It also provides improved root development early in the growing season to have a stronger crop throughout, improves nutrient uptake, and then optimizes some of the crop yields. So because there are some of these benefits with the parcels that do have drainage that isn't installed on them, it does add value to farmland. And so when we were discussing the bill with Representative Purcell, we had brought forward the idea of thinking about adding this through the real estate disclosure process. Made the most sense as we continue to work on this. We are appreciative of the amendment. We would like to continue to work with the author as it moves through the process. There are a few other areas of the language that we'd like to continue discussing. And subdivision 3 is one example, the liability for the failure to disclose. When some of the farmland has moved from landowner to landowner, when some of these original tile lines were put in, they were on paper maps. And if there was a transfer of that land, the map might have not followed with the new landowner. And so trying to make sure that we have a process that would be respectful of looking at some of the different situations that exist. But we appreciate the next step in looking at the amendment and look forward to continuing to work with the author.
Thank you. Scott Gillespie.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Scott Gillespie. I'm from a little town in Johnson, Minnesota, about 3 hours from here. I will have to apologize for not having nearly as good a prepared things because I found out there was a complete amendment when I was about 50 miles out of the cities and I was 100 miles into my trip. And so it's kind of short notice. So I'll keep it pretty short. Just listening to the bill here, from the representative, she did make the comment that it speeds up water going off the farm. I'm going to tell you from a farmer, because I'm a farmer, I'm on a watershed district board, and I'm an auctioneer. And on our farm, it does not speed up water. In fact, it slows it down, and it makes it much more of an even flow and increases holding water capacity for when we do get bigger events so it can do that. And then the comment was made there's no public record, and in a lot of cases that's true. In our watershed district, we have been requiring tiling permits along with working through the our engineer getting everything, and we've been doing that for about 20 years, and anybody can go into that office at any time and find that out. So in some places where the watershed districts aren't in place in Minnesota, that's probably very true, but it is not all the way across the state. From a watershed board, if I'm going to wear my watershed board hat right now, I would ask that possibly with dealing with this, that making a watershed district some incentive to get more of them in the state to help manage some of our drainage and stuff, that would be a pretty important thing. And then I put my auctioneer hat on, and we sell farmland and equipment. And when I'm selling farmland, I'm going to tell you that we never, if we have any records of drain tile, we always disclose that because it always affects the price. And so there is no concerted effort ever to hide anything from anybody that I've ever been involved with or whatever. So I would just ask, I just saw this amendment here 30 minutes ago, and so I'm not quite as prepared as I could have been. That if you got any questions I could possibly answer, I'd love to do that. Otherwise, I will let you get on with your meeting.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against the bill? Mr. Martinson.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Brian Martinson. I'm the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. With the adoption of the delete all, we would like to continue working with the author as the new language creates some new work for county recorders and imposes a new fee and a redistribution of those fee proceeds that the Association of County Recorders has consistently opposed. We look forward to reviewing this. I have sent this out to their association for more feedback. We are curious why the information and funding would need to be redistributed to the state, and look forward to more conversations about the intent for real estate to be covered by this. That is all for now. Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Members, do you have any questions? Representative Gilman.
All right. Thank you, Chair. So one quick question I had is, what will happen with the information once it's collected by Bowser? Will it be posted publicly?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Gilman. I don't believe that to be the case, but I maybe can phone a friend, and the researcher who helped draft this can help refresh my memory.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, that issue is addressed somewhat on the bottom of page 2 of the DE amendment. Beginning on line 2.33, it would require the Board of Water and Soil Resources to maintain the disclosure certificate for at least 6 years and authorize the board to store it as an electronic image. But beyond that, the language in the DE amendment does not specify what the board would do with that information and the extent to which it would be public. I assume because there isn't a cross-reference to the Data Practices Act, the information would be public data and available to the public upon request if in possession of the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you for that information. And then also, has a fiscal note been requested for the bill? And would the 4250 cover Bowser's costs on this?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a fiscal note request, but since there's a DE adopted today, I'll put a new fiscal note request in as soon as the hearing's over, and that'll catch up to the bill hopefully at some point here. I don't know if that amount covers Bowser's costs. So we'll figure that out when we get a fiscal note.
Okay. Thanks so much. Thank you.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question along those lines. Just wanting to confirm, and maybe it's here and we could identify that, but does this apply to all real estate transactions? And if not, can it be scoped possibly to ag lands specifically? That might be helpful rather than to all sale, which the bill author's nodding her head. So,
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification question, Representative Heintzman. That is something that I am working on an amendment before the next committee to clarify that this applies only to agricultural real estate transfer, so not homes, not golf courses. But happy to keep working with you and trying to figure out also how to make sure that it's applying to the correct lands and the correct agricultural lands.
Members, any other questions? I have a question for Mr. Gillespie. Mr. Gillespie, you mentioned the Watershed District. Is that Bois de Sioux?
Yes, it is.
I want to congratulate Bois de Sioux Watershed District for being the one that does keep the records for tiling.
Thank you.
You have done that for 2 decades, as you mentioned, and that does provide information. It would be helpful if the other watershed districts did do it. Your leadership isn't as respected and appreciated.
I'm one member of a 9-person board and the employees, and they're really the ones to thank. I'm probably the least of them.
Share with your colleagues in the other watershed districts.
I will do that. Thank you.
Representative Purcell, do you have any closing comments to the bill as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please vote to send this bill on to Judiciary. Thank you.
Representative Purcell renews her motion that House File 3389 as amended be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. It is adopted. Next up, Representative Purcell, he has House File 3385, Public Waters Definition Modified. Representative Purcell, would you like to move that House File 3385 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill?
So moved.
Representative Purcell, to the bill.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. House File 3385 ensures that Minnesota's protections of our public waters extend to all waters that meet the statutory definition of public water. Minnesota statute defines a public water in Section 103G.005. A list and map of public waters called the Public Waters Inventory, or PWI, was created in the 1980s that attempted to document the public waters of Minnesota. However, there are waters that meet the definition of public waters that are not currently listed on the PWI. Some of these waters were incorrectly deleted by the DNR's own admission from the PWI in 2017, when 640 stream miles across 71 counties were removed from the PWI by the DNR. One of the water courses that was removed in 2017 is a tributary to the Cannon River, which flows through my district. As the former executive director of the Cannon River Watershed Partnership, now Clean River Partners, I know that it matters to local communities to protect our public waters in the local watershed so they can reduce water pollution, protect aquatic habitat, and keep our waters swimmable and fishable. In September of 2022, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that, quote, it is the duty of the legislature to clarify the relationship between the inventory and the statutory definition of public waters. This bill does just that in one additional sentence and clarifies that it is the statutory definition of public waters that governs, regardless of whether a water body has been identified on the PWI or not. And now I'd like to turn over to some testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Carly Griffith, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carly Griffith. I am the Water Program Director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I am here to testify in support of House File 3385. This bill clarifies the relationship between the statutory definition of public waters and the public waters inventory, and it affirms that it is the statutory definition that defines the scope of the state's jurisdiction over public waters. This is an issue that is important to Minnesotans. Public waters are public. That is, they belong to all of us. When Minnesota became a state, its waters were transferred to the state government to be held in trust for its citizens. And in Minnesota, where water is central to our identity, the legislature has taken an expansive view of what counts as a public water. That view is expressed in the statutory definition. The inventory, which was done in the early 1980s, is not 100% accurate and does erroneously leave off some waters that meet the statutory definition. One example led to a lawsuit that eventually landed in the Minnesota Supreme Court. And in that decision, the court agreed that the statutory definition should control for that particular water body, but noted that the legislature should clarify its intent. That's exactly what this bill does. House File 3385 responds to the court case and ensures that all public waters in Minnesota are protected. Minnesota has required permits and categories for environmental review that apply when public waters are impacted. However, those tools are only effective if all public waters are correctly identified. This bill eliminates confusion and provides clarity. It makes sense to bring this clarity to the law at a time when technology such as LIDAR make it easy to verify whether any given water meets the statutory definition. Finally, MCEA does support efforts to make the inventory as accurate as possible. The inventory should continue to be updated so that it can be a useful tool for all stakeholders. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Next up, Peg Fershong, CURE.
Rep.
Representative Hansen and the committee. I'm happy to be here today. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Peg Vershawn, and I am the Director of Programs at CURE in Montevideo. CURE is a nonprofit that has worked on water issues in Minnesota since 1992. This public waters fix is not just an administrative issue. It's a real-world impact on the people and communities across greater Minnesota. One afternoon, I was driving home from work and saw a backhoe out near Limbo Creek, about a third of a mile northwest of our family farm in Renville County. I was surprised. I felt compelled to know what was going on. Renville County, for those of you who may or may not know, has more miles of ditch than it has actually of road. And this section of Limbo Creek near our home is one of the last free-flowing public waters in the entire county. I learned that because Limbo Creek was not correctly identified in the public waters inventory, it was vulnerable to be ditched by a local landowner without the appropriate permit needed. The Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in 2022 protects Limbo Creek, but it doesn't address over 600 miles of public waters that meet the statutory definition of a public water in Minnesota, but are not correctly identified on the inventory. In my capacity at CURE, I see that our constituents all across Minnesota care deeply about water. They look to CURE when it comes to protecting our natural resources. This is why CURE joined MCEA and others to intervene on behalf of Limbo Creek. Furthermore, as we look to the challenges we face in the future with drought and climate impacts, it's imperative that we accurately identify the state water resources and protect those resources for future generations. We ask that you extend the outcome of Limbo Creek decision to ensure that Minnesota public waters are correctly identified and protected all across the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott Sparland, Coalition for a Clean Minnesota River.
Chair Hansen, Vice Chair Jordan, committee members, thank you for hearing my testimony on House File 3385, Defending Public Waters. My name is Scott Sparland. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for a Clean Minnesota River, Coordinator Facilitator for the Minnesota River Congress, and giving testimony today on behalf of the Minnesota River Collaborative. This is my 35th year of working on Minnesota River watershed issues. I'm here today to ask you to begin the process of clarification for the definition of a public water in the state of Minnesota. This has been a long-standing point of contention in Minnesota and a source of litigation that does not have to exist if proper clarity is established by law. In 2022, the Minnesota Supreme Court affirmed that public waters belong to all of us, and as such, we have a voice in how a project impacts us. In the decision, the state's high court agreed with the Court of Appeals that the upper watershed of Limbo Creek is a public water because it meets the statutory definition of a public water. These public water protections are important to CCMR and the collaborative's work in the Minnesota River Basin. This is because in such a completely drained watershed as the Minnesota is, which has so many sediment and nutrient load impairments, it's especially important to ensure that public waters protections like DNR permits are required for all water courses that meet the statutory definition. The statute defines public waters to include natural and altered water courses with a total drainage area of greater than 2 square miles. This is also important to every Minnesota citizen in all parts of this state and will create understanding and awareness for landowners. The court further stated in its decision that it is the duty of the legislature to clarify the relationship between the public waters inventory and the statute definition of public waters. We're here today to ask the legislature to take on that clarification once and for all in order to avoid further pitting neighbor against neighbor, rural resident against urban homeowner, lakeshore property owner against agricultural producer, and the list goes on. The clarification of the definition needs to address and eliminate any vagueness of language in the statute. Definitions need to consider potential attempts to circumvent the law by using alternative terminologies which are not within the spirit and the intent of the law. If this can be achieved, not only will it provide for enhanced public water resource protection, but over time, It will help achieve a degree of cultural harmony and awareness by discouraging covert natural resource modifications as a byproduct. Thank you, Chair Hansen, Vice Chair Jordan, and members of the committee. I'm happy to answer any questions at any time.
Thank you. Jim Seal.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Hansen, Vice Chair Jordan, committee members, for allowing me to testify today. Does everybody have the pretty map? I love maps. I'm a retired hydrologist. I have 34 years with Minnesota DNR in Southwest Minnesota. I worked extensively on drainage projects and public water inventory issues over the last 35 years. On the map that you have in front of you is an example of how the public water inventory maps are in error. There's a water course that goes up through the middle of the red circle there that shows an alternate natural water course as a heavy dashed line. That signifies the heavy dashed lines are altered natural water courses that are regulated by a local drainage authority, typically the county board. If it were a solid line, it would be regulated by the Minnesota DNR. When this mapping was done in the late 70s, early 80s, this water course, which is known as Limbo Creek, was petitioned to be a drainage system in Renville County. That petition failed. Unfortunately, the failure of that petition happened after the DNR published the map for Renville County. And so it's been in existence, as shown as being regulated by the county since 1980, even though there is no county ditch there and no local authority. And that's what precipitated the court case that the other folks that have testified this morning, or excuse me, this afternoon, have mentioned. So this is just one of many examples out there. I could show you sheets of them that exist out there, just my experience as a hydrologist. But making the changes to the statute as outlined in this bill will certainly go a long ways towards allowing the state to update the PWI maps. And so I encourage you as a committee to move this forward and make sure this becomes law. Thank you.
Thank you. Joe Smentek, Minnesota Soybean Growers Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As stated, I'm Joe Smentek. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association. I'm here to speak about our concerns with this change in the definition. Minnesota Soybean, along with Minnesota Corn and another of other ag groups, filed an amicus brief in the case that has been talked about with Limbo Creek, primarily because of our issue with regulatory certainty. When we were negotiating the buffer bill back in 2015 with different parties and in the legislature here, identifying what needed a buffer and what did not need a buffer was very difficult. We started with defined bed and bank, evidence of flow. What does that mean to my farmers? You know, can they go out and see, well, this is a defined bed and bank. There's evidence. They're not hydrologists. They don't know this. They need a identifiable tool that makes it clear what they need to do. That was given through them through the PWI. The definition settled on by the legislature in that bill is that the public waters are those identified on the PWI. Gave them a clear tool, and they didn't do it happily, I will say. They didn't do it of their own free will, but they have shown compliance in the high 90% with that buffer requirement now that they have a clear and identifiable tool. The language change here does not achieve the goal of regulatory certainty. We do not believe it adds the clarity the other testimony provided you with. We think it adds more confusion to my general landowners. There are 11 different sections of the public waters, what is, what is not. Whether a court of competent jurisdiction has determined it's a public water. Whether it drains 2 square miles. These are all things that my members, my landowners, can't easily ascertain. We rely on that definition and the public waters inventory map to be correct so that my landowners know what they need to do and where these public waters are. I don't think that this language goes towards correcting those maps. We believe those maps need to be corrected for regulatory certainty purposes for all the definitions of public water in the statute. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Brian Martinson, Association of Minnesota Counties.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members. I'm Brian Martinson, Environment and Natural Resource Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC would like to express our concerns with House File 3385, which would create regulatory uncertainty related to public waters in the state. In 1979, the Minnesota Legislature directed the Minnesota DNR to create the public waters inventory to serve as an official record of all public waters in the state with the intention of helping to end the proliferation of litigation over public waters. This process involved extensive engagement with state and local governments and the public, and in some cases, judicial review. From a public policy perspective, if a public water is inventoried, it should be entitled to the treatment as a public water. The DNR has statutory authority to maintain and update the inventory, and in the past has taken action to review and reclassify waters if necessary. Counties have a responsibility to manage and protect waters and perform functions that require permitting with state and local governments. For that matter, all Minnesotans need to be mindful of the potential impacts to public waters and to comply with the laws of the state. We deserve to have a well-established inventory of public waters in Minnesota to reliably fulfill our obligations according to the law. The addition of statutory language saying that the inventory no longer serves that purpose takes us backwards. It will not result in less conflict or less litigation. Instead, we should reinvest in proper public engagement process to update the inventory if necessary. Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak for or against the bill? Members, do you have any questions? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Purcell. I have a question. I'm not sure if it is for the bill author or perhaps for DNR, if there's somebody here. Sorry, I don't know where to look here. But I'm not a hydrologist. I'm not extremely familiar with the PWI. It sounds to me like there were some issues around what was and was not included in this work right from the jump. So even separating out the issue that is being resolved in the court case, like how often is the PWI updated? Does it get updated? How long would it take to do another inventory? Is that something that happens regardless of the issue that's being done, or is it sort of we inventoried this once, something's got left off, but we never did it again? Anybody know that?
If someone is from the DNR, maybe they can enlighten us.
If you could introduce yourself for the record. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and members. I'm Randall Doneen with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. The PWI, we do have the ability to make corrections and update it. It's really done on a basis of someone kind of petitions or lets us know. So it's not like a regular interval we did. But if we ever get identified or there's an issue, we'll take a look at the information that they have and we'll register an assessment of, yes, it is a public water or it isn't. Typically, we've actually removed some public water wetlands when a county or somebody has said, hey, we think this was incorrectly identified, and it was. You have to realize back in the 80s, the technology was not as good as it is now for being able to do that. And so there were some errors to make. I think the error that Mr. Seal identified about during the inventory, if we believed it was a part of a drainage system, it was given the heavy dash line and thus wouldn't be regulated. And as part of the buffer law, when we collected the data from those drainage systems, we realized that, you know, some of these never became part of the drainage systems, and so they were incorrectly identified. And we chose at that time not to just add them because those landowners hadn't been notified. So we removed those from the heavy dash line, and we're going through a process of trying to re-add those back. There is, as someone identified, a fair amount of work that would need to be to make all those corrections, but those are things that we're working on.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. I guess just really quickly, a follow-up. How long will that take? Is it just an ongoing process forever?
It is a chair and committee and person. It is a lot of work. You know, what we decided to do was to break it into pieces because there were so many. And so we did a test run with two different counties, Renville and Hope. A lawsuit sort of prevented us from moving forward with that. And then it kind of got tied into the Limbo Creek lawsuit. Those are all been cleared. Those no longer there. And so we are in the process of doing that. But to give everybody proper notice, all the landowners and the counties and the jurisdictions, proper notice, give them an opportunity to give us information and feedback on that, and that us to render a decision statewide is a big effort.
Representative Pickey.
Thank you.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hang on. Yeah, I think you can address my question as well. I just wanted to confirm one way or another if DNR supports this bill.
We have no concerns with the bill. I mean, the statutory definition is how we've been using it. The PWI is a super important tool, and we do need to keep it updated. But the definition is what drives our work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we're obviously trying to work towards a process that is, quite honestly, sounds like we already have. Or maybe there's a tweak that needs to be made. I'm not sure that this bill is the answer, but thank you for your testimony.
Any other questions? Representative Purcell, any closing comments?
This is a simple bill. It adds a single sentence to our statute around the Public Waters Index that our state Supreme Court requested we clarify years ago, and states definitively that the PWI is not gospel. People make mistakes. Just because a water course looks like a water course and deserves the research to make sure that it is a public water course, whether or not it appears on the current PWI. So please vote in favor of my bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell renews her motion that House File 3385 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. Next up. Representative Jordan, Vice Chair Jordan, will be taking the gavel.
Can I have the orange now? I said, I didn't vote against you, so can I have the orange now?
Do you work? No.
Oh, look at her. She aimed that right at me.
Typical.
Next up is House File 3550, related to the Board of Soil and Water Conservation. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move that House File 3550 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like. Members, House File 3550 is a fairly thick bill. Just to give you a little background on it, I had asked the Board of Water and Soil Resources to look at provisions within their jurisdiction on updating, that a lot of this law is very old and needs some modernization. Also, there are some provisions that are agency initiatives in here. So the Bowser bill, 3550, should be clear that I asked for it. In conversations with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, they did propose some changes with this to help clarify things, primarily in the wetland area, because there's been some changes with court decisions. There are some updates, but most importantly, we do not have a target yet. We may not get a target. So we're taking the fiscal component out of the bill because we still deal with fiscal policy, it needs to go to Ways and Means, but the purpose of the A1 amendment, other than some tweaking, is to take the money out of the bill. So it would be a pure policy.
Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would ask that Mr. Jashke, the Executive Director, come forward. When you look through, I don't want to walk through everything, but just some summaries, I want to clarify a couple of particular importance. One is the powers and duties. It would allow Bowser to shift funding for technical, financial, administrative assistance to leverage federal and other non-state money to address high-priority needs. Sometimes we have the CREP program where there's an opportunity to get some additional federal money. Also, we have the IIJA and Inflation Reduction Act money where there may be opportunity to get some of those funds having the ability to change those within the structure is important. With that, I would defer to Mr. Jashke.
First on my list of testifiers is John Jashke from the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Jashke, Executive Director of Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I will walk through pieces of the bill, and there's a couple other testifiers, too, that will cover the Soil and Water Conservation District provisions and the Watershed District provisions, respectively. On Section 2, this incorporates the Minnesota Public Drainage Manual as a...
Director Jashke, can you pull the... Sorry to interrupt. Can you pull the microphone a little bit closer? Thank you. Please proceed.
Is that any better, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Some new equipment on the way, maybe. This drainage stakeholder provision is allowing the public drainage manual, which is something that the stakeholder group along with the agency have been working on for decades and was funded by the legislature, to be acknowledged in statute and provide a mechanism to keep it currently and continually updated. I will actually turn to Ms. Vanney, if that's okay, Madam Chair, as the testifier on the Soil and Water Conservation District provisions that are beginning in Section 3.
Yep, Sheila Vanney, Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Sheila Vanney, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And I want to express our support of the changes outlined with regard to Chapter 103C, the SWCD law. I won't go through them in a lot of detail. Most of them are just technical conforming changes. But one thing to point out is there is a repealer later on in the bill with regard to a provision in 103A. So at one point, powers that be decided it would be good to have the soil and water conservation policy of the state be in 103A and 103C. Over the years, one got updated to reflect soil health and the other didn't. And so now we're just kind of determining that 103C is where the soil and water conservation policy will live and making sure that it's up to date with that soil health reference. By and large, again, Madam Chair, the other changes are extremely technical in nature. Also over the years, SWCDs are given duties and responsibilities in other areas of statute that aren't captured in 103C. So we want to make sure that we're referencing those other statutory responsibilities when we talk about the scope of work within 103C. That's what those the changes that say other statutory authorities, those changes apply to that. And then on the comprehensive plan in section 12, SWCDs currently can voluntarily put together a comprehensive plan. What is lacking in that current process is the public interfacing. And so we're incorporating notice and comment and public hearings into our comprehensive planning efforts to put them on equal footing with other local government comprehensive plan efforts. That brings us to section 13 and onward. Again, very technical changes. And the new subdivision 21 on page 9, I'll just point out, isn't truly enabling any additional powers or duties for an SWCD. It's restating what's in other sections of the statute, but in a more straightforward and modern way of specifying it, as well as bringing in opportunities for partnerships with tribal governments. The last part that relates to 103C is subdivision 22, to make it clear that SWCDs have the authority to take out loans. Currently, that is not specified in statute. And Madam Chair, that concludes the 103C changes.
Thank you, Assistant Director Vanney. Director Jashke, do you have additional walkthrough to do, or can we proceed to other testimony?
Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, I'd like to have Lewis Smith, Smith Partners, walk through the watershed district provisions in Chapter 103D, and I'll come back.
Great. Lewis Smith, please proceed to the chair. State your name again for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Lewis Smith, I'm counsel for Minnesota Watersheds and the Red River Watershed Management Board. Thank you very much for this opportunity. We've worked for more than 10 years on identifying updates needed to the Watershed Act. We can all be proud of the Watershed Act as a unique approach to managing water resources in the nation, but it's a 1955 statute and needs some updating. We've worked through an exhaustive process with our members and identified the changes that are before you. They really fall into three main categories. One relates to the governance of watershed districts. The second relates to the planning process and makes a more clear, uniform planning process that strengthens the role of watershed districts in that process. And finally, we have simplified the process to deliver watershed district projects more efficiently taken a variety of confusing different processes and made them more straightforward. Be pleased to answer any questions you may have, but we're eager and thankful for Representative Hansen's support and leadership.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Back up, I think, is Director Jashke.
Yeah, thank you again, Madam Chair, members. The next section in the bill has to do with the Reinvest in Minnesota. I'm sorry, I missed one. There's actually an amendment in the incorporation from the amendment that brings in Chapter 103E. There's a consensus provision from the Drainage Work Group to provide an extension to a sunset provision of 5 years, and that has consensus, so that's being added in via the amendment. As I mentioned, Reinvest in Minnesota is our voluntary conservation easement program, which we've had in place for several decades, and as Chair mentioned, you know, we use that program to leverage federal money and accomplish easement results with federal and state money put together. And this language in the bill is bringing in provisions that are currently in a Minnesota rule that are important. And with that, then we would ask the legislature to repeal the rule so we don't have that administrative responsibility to kind of run both of those things. It's just a lot easier to put it all in the statute. We also rely on the statutory rider language to direct how that spending occurs, and these are provisions that would support that. There is a provision in section 103, I'm sorry, I got to fix section first here. Okay, in 103F, there is a provision that allows for the agency to review the standards that are in a county ordinance or a watershed district rule as they carry out the buffer law, which was referred to earlier. That provision would make that responsibility ongoing in case those organizations change their ordinance or their rule, so those can be reviewed again to make sure they are currently meeting the statutory requirements. Then the rest of this is largely focused on the Wetland Conservation Act, which begins on section 74. And there's several pieces in here that are in the bill because of a Supreme Court case that took place in late May of this last year, Sackett versus EPA, which changed the federal jurisdiction over wetlands, waters of the U.S. The state law, which was passed originally in 1991, had connections to those federal authorities in several different ways, including classification systems and typing systems, as well as relying on those federal decisions to meet state standards. The changes that are being made in here are to basically bring us back to the level of protection that we had with the state and federal law being jointly exercised prior to that Supreme Court case that occurred in May. A couple of examples that we're paying attention to in this bill, I think, that are worth noting is on agricultural land, we're going to try and use a USDA determination as the mechanism to authorize impacts to wetlands on agricultural land, and that is currently in place. The state law doesn't recognize it completely. We think that would be the best way to make that work for producers and to protect our wetlands to the standard that the state has in place already. The requirement would be for that producer, that landowner, to share that USDA information, which is private, with the local governments and the state if necessary. There's another exemption on drainage, which we're really just cleaning up to make sure that that continued right to do maintenance is established and continued as was for a period of time that goes 25 years past the reformation of a wetland that remains intact. We're also making some changes to the de minimis exemption, which is the amount that can be drained or filled without mitigation. The changes really are just to get that statute both simplified and also to bring it in conformance with the way the federal agencies view things, including removing the typing language as best we can, the wetland typing, because the feds do not acknowledge that. We are retaining the geographical differences that Minnesota has from one part of our state to another. The greater than 80% area refers to the part of the Minnesota that had had very small amounts of wetland loss and a large amount of wetlands to begin with. And of course, other areas of the state have had more wetland losses. So we're reflecting those geographic differences that remains in this bill. Acknowledging some of the authorizations that the federal government continues to have over certain types of projects, including aquaculture, utilities, and those types of projects, that all remains in here. And I think with that, there was one amendment, one provision in the amendment that also was added that includes some mechanism through rulemaking to protect those water courses that have been removed from federal jurisdiction that are not public waters, and that would be through a rulemaking process, rulemaking authority that already exists. And then, as the chair mentioned, the appropriation language in the bill was removed as to make this a pure policy bill. So, and you can see there, of course, in the bill is the language that's being removed in the repealers as well. So thank you, Madam Chair, for that opportunity to walk through the bill.
Thank you, Director Jashke. Last for testimony, I have Brian Martinson. Please approach the table. I introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Proceed. Good afternoon. I'm Brian Martinson, Environment and Natural Resource Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I would like to speak to one section of the bill, Section 59, which addresses or is related to local jurisdiction to enforce the state buffer law. The adoption of enforcement jurisdiction is granted to local jurisdictions, counties, and watersheds after Bowser review of local ordinances or official controls to ensure they are adequate. Section 59 adds that this authority is revocable. However, this language falls short of explaining how and under what circumstances the jurisdiction can be revoked. AMC feels it's important that the language be clearer in this regard. The language should explain the circumstances under which this authority can be revoked. If the official controls do not remain in compliance or are not being implemented, it should require that a notice of the ordinance or implementation deficiencies be given to the local government and an opportunity to come into compliance. And it should state who officially has the ability to revoke that authority, which we believe should be done by board action. I have made Bowser staff aware of this recommendation, and we would be happy to work with board staff and the author on language to address these issues.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony in 2 minutes or less.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Don Arnosti, and I'm testifying as an interested public citizen in this instance. I've been involved with this law since the original writing and passage, so I'm quite familiar with the provisions of it. I want to draw your attention to the proposed revision in section 79 on page 47. There's 47.8 and 47.9 specifically. I'm trying to understand why that language is being struck, and I recommend that it not be struck. And the reason I say that is it is my informed opinion that this sort of language has actually resulted in the most protection of wetlands, more than the rest of the bill. The fact that people who come forward with proposals are first required to minimize their impacts before they go into any regulatory process. I note that in this section, realignment of utility lines is being added to what in essence is not going to be required to minimize the direct and indirect impacts. We've had recent utility line realignments with massive wetland impacts, and I think it is very important that line 47.8 and 47.9 be retained in the law to apply to utility projects so that the utility companies are asked to minimize their impacts as under current law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Arnosky. I believe there is another public testifier who wished to speak. Hello. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony in 2 minutes or less.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity, committee members, to testify before you. My name is John Waller. I live at 14010 Homestead Avenue, Hugo, Minnesota, 55038-8427. And for a full disclosure, I'm a manager on the Rice Creek Watershed District, but I do not speak for my colleagues today. I'm here to speak as an individual. I've represented Washington County for 18 years on the Watershed District. I'm here to ask you today to remove Section 42.103D.357, removal of managers. The language there, which refers to malfeasance, nonfeasance, and misfeasance, exists in other portions of the state statute for public officials. But this would be the first time that the code of ethics of a watershed district would be the basis for removal of a manager. I had the experience of my colleagues attempting to remove me under this issue. This is a current rule in the metropolitan area. And I do, Rice Creek is in the metro area. There were tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees spent on this. 600 pages of material was sent to the county attorney at Washington County to determine there was no issue with malfeasance, nonfeasance, or misfeasance. And as a result, the county board didn't even hold a vote. They just moved on. My point to you here is that ethics are something that that the majority of the board decides what's good for themselves. It's not determined by somebody else. It sounds great. You'd love to have it done. But in the end of it, it was used here for a means to silence my voice of accountability. Now, no doubt you'll hear some rebuttal to my remarks. But believe me, folks, this doesn't, it's well-meaning, but good intentions, but it won't get the job done. It's just duplicative, unnecessary language. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Heintzman.
Looks like they're visiting. I'll wait a second.
Representative
Heintzman. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So this last testimony was interesting. We'll probably have some more questions along those lines, but I think the bill author is probably looking at that right now. The other testimony that was, I don't know, I'll just say interesting rather than concerning, because I think there's probably an opportunity to work on it, is on that section in 29.26 through 29.29. And in that testimony, I think we're hearing that this issue of determination being revocable could be a challenge. So I just want to confirm that Bowser and the bill author are interested or willing to work on that and find out if we can get stakeholders to
Representative
come
Hansen.
And have a part of this. Thank you. Sorry.
And my apologies. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Heinzman, I think those are clarifying things that we can work on before the next stop. I think you're on Ways and Means, right? So you'll have the memory of this discussion. I do look favorably on Mr. Arnosti's testimony as well in terms of a correction. And I know we have a lot of testimony later on a different bill. So.
Representative Feinstein, any follow-up?
No, that's fine. We'll look at it at the next stop.
Any other questions from members? Representative Hansen, closing comments.
I renew my motion that House File 3550, as amended, be recommended, re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. I believe we will have a couple of tweaks to be done there as well.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3550, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. That I will be handing the gavel back to Chair Hansen.
Hey, we got our stuff.
Yeah.
Hey, Rick. Can't make them stay.
Yeah.
Make them stay.
See the doors.
They only want to hear about Rick stuff.
Yeah, it's all about Rick.
Oh, hey, we voted for you. We just laid it over.
So
nobody voted.
As we're in this transition, members, just a bit on this transition, and for members of the audience, we're encouraged by the Sergeant of Arms not to have people standing in the background. If you can take a seat, to please take a seat. I anticipated that there may be some movement of people out of chairs after one of the bills, so thank you for that, and we will proceed with Representative Jordan's bill. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 3200 be laid over.
Representative Jordan moves that House File 3200 be laid over. I believe you have a DE1.
I do, Mr. Chair, and I move that amendment. And as a bit of an explanation, it is the vast majority of this amendment is technical. Some highlights include a ramp up on rates to ease retailers and consumers into the program. It makes the program optional for retailers to operate a redemption site. It removed cartons and pouches from the program and added a refund value for MRFs. As for member support on the amendment.
Any questions to the DE1 amendment? Members, any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. DE1 is adopted. Representative Jordan, to House File 3200 as amended.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. As members know, we discussed Minnesota's waste problem extensively yesterday, and a big part of that is our beverage containers that we lose to roadways, waterways, and landfills, and trash incinerators. The Container Recycling Institute estimates that each year, 3.8 billion beverage containers sold in Minnesota that are collectively worth $47.2 million are put in landfills or burned. That is over 660 beverage containers that are littered per Minnesotan. And this problem exists because our current recycling system is not working well enough. The Recycling Partnership's 2024 State of Recycling Report says that Minnesota has a 20% recycling rate, and it also finds that 30% of Minnesotans have zero access to recycling in our state. Even if curbside recycling is improved, it doesn't address the one-third of beverage containers that are consumed on the go. This bill was introduced so Minnesota can implement an environmental policy that is proven in the United States and around the world that consistently achieves significantly higher beverage container recycling rates. And this is in the form of recycling refunds. In a recycling refund system, consumers buy the beverage and borrow the container. They pay a small refundable deposit for each beverage container they purchase and receive that deposit back upon returning the container at a convenient redemption location. The results are proven. Beverage containers sold with a deposit in 10 states that have these programs are recycled at 2 to 3 times the rate as beverage containers sold without a deposit around the country. In a modern recycling refund system, across the 40 countries that have one, several of them consistently achieve greater than 90% redemption rates. And we should bring this to Minnesota. If we did, the Container Recycling Institute has found that with an 80% redemption rate, an additional 5% of beverage containers recycled via the curbside system, nearly 200,000 tons of material would now get recycled annually, which would lead to greenhouse gas emissions savings equivalent to taking more than 53,000 cars off the road for an entire year. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has an analysis determining that a recycling refund system would create a net gain of over 1,000 jobs. And we can get these environmental and economic impacts without raising taxes. The ultimate responsibility for managing and financing the program would be on distributors and importers of beverages into the state, with all revenue created by the program going towards operating it. There are also provisions in the bill to minimize any potential burdens on material recovery facilities, or MRFs, and retailers. With the recycling refund program, our state could protect the environment and stimulate the economy by having many more beverage containers recycled rather than littered, landfilled, or burned. With that, I would like to turn to testimony, Mr. Chair. I understand there's quite a bit.
And Representative Jordan and members in the audience, because we took a little longer, we're going to have to cut the testimony to a minute and a half.
One minute
instead of 2 minutes. So, Kate Bailey, Association of Plastic Recyclers. Unless Representative Heinzman, you want to go to five? Kate Bailey, Association of Plastic Recyclers.
Good afternoon, Chair Hansman and committee members. You heard from me yesterday. I represent the Association of Plastic Recyclers. We are here in support of a better recycling system. This and in tandem of the bill that we heard yesterday. I want to talk today about this bill, about the supply chain. So our role as recyclers is not to manage waste. We actually collect and process materials and then sell them back to manufacturers. So we are part of the feedstock for U.S. manufacturing. Companies have committed to using more recycled plastics and are required by law to use more recycled plastics. We cannot get enough recycled water bottles and soda bottles to meet U.S. demand for the manufacturing for those recycled plastics. We have members importing plastics from other countries to meet this demand. Meanwhile, we are literally throwing those bottles away, littering them in the streets or waterways of Minnesota. So this bill is an opportunity to clean up that litter, improve recycling, and support U.S. domestic manufacturing. Thank you.
Thank you. Nicholas Hartsey, Teamsters Local 792.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nicholas Hartsey, and I'm a business agent with Teamsters Local 792, also a trustee on the board. I've worked in the beverage industry for 12 years for the company PepsiCo. 2,000 Teamsters produce and distribute products that are affected by this bill every day, from beer, pop, and everything in between. We recognize the importance of recycling and definitely support the efforts to increase recycling rates. However, we have serious concerns about how this bill would affect our industry and our union jobs. This bill will pass the cost of the tax to the consumer, and it remains unclear if it will increase recycling rates that are already in the top 10 of the nation. For example, a case of beer will cost $2.40 more. That increase in cost to consumers will reduce demand for bottled beverages, including pops, sport drinks, and beer. A reduction in demand could lead to the loss of good union jobs across the state. Additionally, a bill like this adds strain to our retail partners, adding burden to small businesses that are already fighting hard to make ends meet. This bill doesn't hurt big businesses, large corporations, and their executives. It hurts mom-and-pop shops, the backbones of Main Street workers with union jobs to provide them security. Finally, it punishes people who are already recycling and doing the right thing, making those who already recycle pay more upfront for the products they like and burden them to clean, store, bag, and transport to a collection site. We should be making it easier for people to recycle, not harder. Thank you for all your time and attention. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Scott Breen, Can Manufacturers Institute.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. I'm Scott Breen of Can Manufacturers Institute, or CMI. We represent U.S. metal can makers and their suppliers. Our members have several facilities in Minnesota, including Crown's Beverage Can Manufacturing Plant in Mankato. There's a letter of support in the record from Ryan Holla, the plant manager there. CMI supports House File 3200 because we need more used cans to make new cans. More cans recycled means making cans with less carbon and with less virgin aluminum, which is carbon intensive and imported. We'd much rather have a larger, consistent, high-quality domestic supply of material to make new cans. The U.S. manufactured can averages 73% recycled content. We can only get that higher if there's a greater supply of recycled material. The same goes for the plastic and glass industry. There's only one proven solution to get beverage container recycling consistently above 90%. That's recycling refunds. And it's popular in the 10 states that currently have it. Over 90% of voters there said they support it. And nationally, the support was above 70% regardless of party affiliation. This bill will create a modern system that has provisions to address concerns around consumer convenience, making recycling sortation facilities whole, and being curbside compatible. I was reminded in the past 24 hours of the impact of this bill. I saw cans in the garbage in the Department of Transportation cafeteria, even with a recycling bin right next to it. I was running this morning along Minnesota Street, Wabasha Street Bridge, picking up cans and bottles, putting them in the recycling bins there. But these examples demonstrate that simply providing recycling access isn't enough for beverage containers. We need this financial incentive. It works, and Minnesota can be a leader in creating a modern recycling refund system, thereby cleaning up its streets, creating jobs, and keeping valuable materials in domestic manufacturing rather than Minnesota landfills and natural areas. Thank you.
Next up, Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. On deck, Lucy Mullaney, Eureka Recycling. And then Tim Wilkins. Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As I mentioned yesterday, Minnesota is one of the leading states in recycling. One of them that we're really good at is aluminum because of our majority of our citizens have access to curbside recycling. I mentioned the solid waste tax yesterday. This would be another tax on top of that, starting at 5 cents, then moving up to 10 cents in 2030, along with the ability to be increased by the commissioner. So besides the cost concerns, Mr. Chairman and members, it's how the implementation of this program would work within the existing system. I think it'd be a struggle for the hospitality industry, but also public institutions, including sporting venues, public parks, hospitals, and schools. Also multifamily residences. Second concern also is how the non-redeemable containers, whether they're crushed or damaged, and how those would be treated, and also how the collection sites and mobile units would be working that are mentioned in the bill, Mr. Chairman, within the existing system. I think that the education component is important. I cannot go without mentioning Minnesota WasteWise and then also the Carver, Dacona, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington County Recycling Exists program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Lucy Mullaney, Eureka Recycling, then Tim Wilkin, and then Dylan DeThomas.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, members of the committee, and Rep. Jordan for her commitment to this issue. I'm Lucy Mullaney. I'm the Director of Policy with Eureka Recycling, and I'm here today as a MRF operator. We are an operator of a material recovery facility, a MRF, and I want to address specific concerns around the impact of recycling refund program we'll have on MRFs. So while MRFs will see beverage containers coming through the curbside program, we know that some residents will still recycle in the curbside just as they do in bottle bill states. And this bill addresses concerns about MRFs losing some of the most valuable materials to redemption centers by compensating MRFs a processing fee for beverage containers that come through our curbside program. This processing fee is based on 80% of the refund value. Based on our own internal economic modeling, which tested out different scenarios and similar modeling done by our partners, the processing fee more than makes up the difference for the containers lost to redemption centers and far exceeds the amount MRFs are currently receiving in the marketplace. Not only does this help MRFs, but it also allows for increased financial support to local communities through established revenue shares. It provides the financial support to pay for the MRF upgrades, and it ensures we have a guaranteed market for beverage containers. Representative Jordan has taken a very thoughtful approach to this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Tim Wilkin, Minnesota Beverage Association, then Dylan DeThomas, the Recycling Partnership, and then Joel Carlson. Mr. Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Tim Wilkin. I'm president of the Minnesota Beverage Association, the makers and distributors of non-alcoholic beverages in the state. Recycling and recyclability has been a long-time priority for our members, and we prioritize making our packaging 100% recyclable. We encourage you, instead of this bill, to look at dedicating the solid waste tax, 100% of the solid waste tax, to the original purpose, to managing solid waste and improving our recycling infrastructure and creating sustainable consumer education. Currently, 27% of this tax is going to the general fund. I'm here today with a group of business, agricultural, and labor groups in opposition to this bill. We have successfully created a system in Minnesota that ranks among the best in the nation. We created a system that is successful at all materials, not just a select few, and we do better at all materials than do bottle bill states. This will hurt consumers by increasing the price due to the not only the deposit but also the tax that's built in and hidden from the system. And it's also consumers have to take the sticky empties, and it's kind of a gross system. I lived under this in college in Iowa, so I encourage you to vote no. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dylan DeThomas, the Recycling Partnership, then Joel Carlson, and then Jennifer DeJournet.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, members of the committee, and Representative Jordan for your commitment to this issue. For the record, my name is Dylan DeThomas, and I represent the Recycling Partnership, and I'm testifying in support of House File 3200, especially when paired with the EPR bill that we talked about yesterday. I lead state policy work for the Recycling Partnership. We're funded by big companies and packaging manufacturers to help support their sustainability goals, which I'm happy to go into. We talked about that yesterday as well. We talked about the EPR component of how to address the solid waste crisis here in Minnesota. DRS is a kind of EPR that, with well-designed, can have an incredible impact on improving recycling rates, achieving beverage container recycling rates more than 80%, while in states that don't have it are around 30%. It's also preferred as a way to get at the reuse and refill goals that are in that EPR bill. You can't do it without a system like this, in particular for materials like glass. We know that well-designed and implemented EPR and DRS system programs in tandem can bring great environmental and economic benefits. These programs will create and maintain jobs across the state. Thank you for including me in this hearing.
Joel Carlson, Minnesota Wine and Spirit Wholesalers, Jennifer DeJournet after that, and then Brant Irwin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the Minnesota Wine and Spirit Wholesalers Association. I'm not going to let you tap your gavel. So our Minnesota-based members, all family-owned, distribute between 75 and 80% of the wine and spirits in the state of Minnesota. We have great concerns about this bill, and I'll just say this. All those nickels and dimes that get refunded come directly from our clients. It's millions for us, and it is a significant problem for the benefit that we think we'll get. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jennifer DeJournet, Clean Water Action, then Brant Irwin, and then Kurt Kadelka.
Good evening, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. I am speaking on behalf of Ivana Stark, State Director of Clean Water Action. She was supposed to be here today, but unfortunately fell down the stairs. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 3200. Yesterday you heard about the dangers of plastics and microplastics they pose to human health. Plastic bottles, bottle waste, are just another contributor to the growing plastic waste problem we have. When pop was first bottled in the beginning of the 20th century, it cost 5 cents and deposits were two cents. 40% of the cost of pop was the deposit. A survey conducted in the 20s concluded that 80% of the bottlers had a deposit system. The reclamation system worked because bottles were kept out of the waste stream. Unfortunately, we have backslid, and the bottles that are being kept are that aren't being recycled are being put into our landfills where they're piling up and this waste has grown. Around the 1960s, alarm over the waste and pollution began to emerge. Rather than being proactive in our efforts along the way, we shifted responsibility to consumers versus focusing on partnering with industry and producing the producers of the product in the first place. Collaboration and waste reduction should have always been our focus. Currently, the 10 states that have bottle bills have high reclamation rates of 70 to 85%, and Americans, 50 billion of the bottles per year are being taken care of. So thank you very much, and we ask you to support this bill.
If you could just state your name for the record. Oh,
Jennifer DeJorna. Thank you.
Brant Irwin, Minnesota Beer Wholesalers Association, then Kurt Kadelka, and then Tony Chesek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brant Irwin. I'm the president of the Minnesota Beer Wholesalers Association. We are the trade association, family-owned distributors, primarily malt beverages, that employ thousands of Minnesotans throughout the state. I am here to provide testimony in opposition to House File 3200. This bill would obligate every wholesaler and importer in the state to join a distributor and importer responsibility organization. It's important to note that the language of the bill includes those breweries and farm wineries that self-distribute who would also be considered wholesalers under the bill and be obligated to join this group. The legislation as proposed is not adding on to the existing recycling infrastructure in place. Instead, it's circumventing the existing system and creating a new system to be operated by businesses that don't have the infrastructure in place to do so. The obligations being passed on to that new organization under this bill are currently being performed by waste and trash haulers and recycling companies, each of whom is in fact designed for these specific purposes. As already identified, Minnesota ranks in the top 10 in recycling rates of common containers and packaging materials. I ask you to please not disrupt a system that's working very well. Thank you.
Kurt Kadelka, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, then Tony Chesek, and then Bruce Newstead.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name, for the record, is Kurt Kadelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We talked yesterday really quickly about the 5.9 million-ton waste problem we have here in Minnesota. And we wanted to remind you that the legislature set out some aggressive goals, including 75% recycling in the metropolitan area. However, even with a greater opportunity to recycle beverage containers than others and a wide public understanding that cans and beverage containers are recyclable, we're not hitting the 75%. In fact, for aluminum cans, for instance, we're only at 57%. Why does this matter? Well, there are environmental impacts as a result of this. One example is it takes 90% more energy to produce an aluminum can from virgin imported or compared to recycled materials. Aluminum is also very valuable, and every time we throw one can into the landfill, we're throwing away money. Beverage container refund programs have proven effective across this nation and also the globe. And it is also a platform that we can build on reusable and refillable container systems that will have greater environmental benefits. It's an area we'd like to continue to work with the proposers on. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Tony Chesek, Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, then Bruce Newstead, and then Jill Sims.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and committee. First off, I want to thank Representative Jordan for the DE amendment. We really appreciate that. The majority of our industries already operate in single-digit profit margins. This bill will increase costs at all levels of manufacturing, distributing, and retailing when the cost of goods and services are seemingly outpacing current market profitability. If a bar or restaurant wants to recoup the increased costs incurred, they will then have to store these containers. That both poses increased foot traffic for those looking to cash in on those unattended containers outside and pose a myriad of health risks and violations if they are to be stored indoors where space and accessibility are in question. For clarification, on-premise liquor license holders who are bars, restaurants, tap rooms, and brew pubs oftentimes absorb the cost of such cost increases. Only when it is financially out of scope do retailers pass these costs along to their beloved customers. Wholesalers joining an association, pivoting on current business models and causing disruption in the system, retail will be forced to raise costs to those who are already strapped. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Bruce Newstead, Minnesota Retailers Association, Jill Sims, Hospitality Minnesota, and Jamie Fuel, President of the Grocers Association.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Newsted with the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a trade group of about 1,200 stores across Minnesota, including Main Street businesses and some of the national brands that you're familiar with. I'm here to express our opposition to House File 3200, but I first want to flag, as Mr. Chesick did, a part of the bill that we appreciate. And we appreciate the delete all and how Reverend Jordan made accommodations for retailers relative to their voluntary participation versus mandatory participation based on experiences in other states. We know that's an important part of this bill, so thank you. Even with that provision, we're concerned that the bill will have negative impacts on consumers across Minnesota. The bill will create higher costs for Minnesotans, including seniors and low-income individuals who will bear the costs of those increases and really will have to pay more products for the more price for the products that they enjoy and rely on today. Retailers, as you've heard, will also face competitive challenges, particularly in border communities. In these communities where it's easy to kind of slide across the river, like my hometown of 101 Minnesota, or go across the street or the highway, higher prices will result in consumers making purchases in other states, sending those dollars elsewhere, and impacting their other purchases, including the rest of the market basket. You've also heard how it'll be an inconvenience for consumers. So, Mr. Chair, I just want to end with a thank you for your time today. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on this bill.
Jill Sims, Hospitality Minnesota, Jamie Fuhl, and then David Ring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jill Sims, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Hospitality Minnesota. We are opposed and concerned about the many difficult challenges this bill will place on the hospitality industry, specifically our restaurants, breweries, and wineries. This bill increases costs for hospitality operators, hurts competitiveness of our small businesses, and complicates health and safety and regulatory compliance. Please consider the impact it has to our small businesses who produce and distribute in Minnesota. This bill does not account for the strict regulations around the labeling of our beverage products and significant financial cost to change a label or to reprint cans. To put things into perspective, something that may seem as small as making a label change can cost upwards of $5,000 per brand, not just per business. So if you have 12 styles of beer, that's $60,000. Not to mention, businesses typically buy in extreme bulk quantities and have 6 to 12 months on hand. An additional challenge for our small businesses is the financial obligation to the organization as well. It's a little bit ambiguous, and right now that doesn't allow for our businesses to financially plan, and we are on razor-thin margins. Every day, more and more is placed on the operators' plates and businesses across Minnesota. We're still financially strained and recovering, so we cannot shoulder this burden, and we ask that you oppose. Thank you.
Jamie Fuhl, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association, then David Ring.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, thank you. I am Jamie Poole, president of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and we're here to express our concerns with House File 3200. As an industry, we take our role as an environment steward serious. I'm going to talk a little bit about the functionality and our concerns there. You're asking us to take on additional roles within the community. We're not waste haulers. Food safety and cleanliness is a top priority of being a responsible food retailer. If grocery and convenience stores are not sanitary, the consequences could be deadly. Our members that operate in other states shared that customers do bring in very unsanitary containers. We also know this from our bag take-back programs. They attract pests from rodents to ants. Because of the Midwestern climate, these take-back centers are customarily located within the store, very close to food products. The bill does allow for retailers to opt in and opt out. For locations that have redemption centers, they'll need additional staffing to operate the machines and troubleshoot. Pest control measures, none of these expenses are reimbursable to the retailer. Also, we are not a financial collection. But I just want to say that interchange fees on all of this will be also charged, so retailers have to pick up those costs. So there's a lot to go that goes into this bill. Thank you.
David Ring, Quick Trip.
Quick Trip, 2 minutes.
Try to be brief. I know we're coming up against the 4:30 hour. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Jordan, members of the committee. My name is Dave Ring. I'm the Community Government Relations Manager for Quick Trip. We own and operate 870 stores in six states, including 213 here in Minnesota, where we employ over 8,700 people. We take recycling very seriously. We have recycling containers at all of our stores in Minnesota, and annually at all of our 870 stores, we recycle over 13,700 tons of cardboard and over 27,700 tons of mixed recycling, that being aluminum, plastic, and glass beverage containers. Well, the recycling initiatives in the recently revised HF 3200 are voluntary, which we appreciate. QuickTrip has opposed this legislation for the following reasons. Minnesota's recycling rate stands at 49%, which ranks 7th in the country, which shows that curbside recycling, the efforts of retailers like our company and others, and well-developed recycling programs in Minnesota are working. They may not be perfect, and there may be work to do, but we are outpacing many other states, including several that are, already have mandatory bottle container legislation in place. Implementing a bottle container law, voluntary or not, appears to only address 3% of the waste stream. We would encourage the committee to vote against this and commit the solid waste tax for its intended purpose. Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak for or against the bill? Anyone else in the audience? So we have Representative Gilman first, and then Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair. So quick question for the author of the bill. So how will this program work in greater Minnesota? Like how many redemption sites? And could we, how would that work in sparsely populated areas?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are convenience factors that are put into the bill that the DERO would be administering, and there would be people on the DERO who would be from both greater Minnesota and the metro area. There are convenience standards that would be enforced and created, and those would be enforced by the program itself. So that would be determined there.
Representative Gilman.
Okay. And then again, so then do you have also in the bill another, just a ballpark idea of what it would cost to operate the redemption sites, mobile centers, and kiosks?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, those would be determined by the DERO, and that would be part of the fees that the importers would be paying, and they would also be factored into the sites would be paid for by the beverage distributors and the people who are paying into it, and as part of the unredeemed deposits. I don't have an estimate on how much each individual redemption site would be. I don't know, perhaps Mr. Breen might be able to better discuss how much they cost in other states.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. So it'll vary by the type of redemption site. So we keep it very flexible in the bill because we wanted this DERO to be able to operate the right system in the right place and to not have too many of them. So you were asking about how many sites. If we put in the bill, there needs to be X sites in every county. There could be some counties that have too many or too little. So we wanted to have a convenience standard established and then the right amount of redemption sites and the right kind of redemption sites to be put in place to meet that convenience standard and to meet the performance targets. In terms of the overall cost, there was an MPCA study that said that this could cost overall a couple hundred million dollars, but then the money would come from the unredeemed refunds as well as the sale of the containers that are redeemed as well as the fee to the distributors and importers.
So that sounds very expensive. And so.
Yes.
That's a big concern. Thanks.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hanson, Representative Jordan. So coming up from county government, Winona County has what I would consider to be a very high functioning recycling program. We have carts at every single residence throughout the rural area and throughout the county. Part of the way that we were able to get people to warm up to this idea was the no sort recycling. So now we're going back away from no sort recycling into sorting out this particular stream. And more importantly, the economy of scale of driving just one truck around these entire greater Minnesota rural areas rather than having 10 competing trucks competing for garbage. So I'm wondering specifically, do you have any data on the carbon footprint that's going to be added back into the environment when we have people in the rural areas bringing these items in individually rather than the way we do it now with picking all this up in just one stop?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the idea of this is that you would be able to combine trips. So if you're going into town to buy pop, you can bring back your empty pop cans. So it wouldn't be replacing an extra trip. And to the point about the single sort, you could still continue to put your cans and bottles into your blue bin or whatever color bin. Is it blue in Winona County?
Blue bins, yeah.
Blue bin there too. You could still put your cans in or bottles in the blue bin, and those county haulers would still be able to pick them up.
Okay. One follow-up question. Yeah. So, again, the highest value, so I've toured these MRF facilities, and they do just an excellent job, and the exactly what you want to see done with the recycling is being done. So you take out the most valuable pieces from the county, the aluminum and the plastic bottles. Will you have a way to reimburse the counties for the money that you're taking from their programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there would be, I think it would be better if we had someone from the MRFs to speak to it. So I would ask Lucy Mulaney to come back up and talk about how that would work.
Mulaney could. Just a reminder that this bill is being laid over.
Thank you. We've worked closely on the language. MRFs would receive a reimbursement for the beverage containers that they're still processing. And the reimbursement would be based on a percentage of the refund value. So the language has it at 80% of the refund value, which is considerably more than what we're receiving per PET bottle or per aluminum can in the current marketplace.
Yeah, one more follow-up question. So we spent an exorbitant amount of time negotiating contracts with different recycling companies. So again, you're taking out the valuable part of the recycling stream. So we're actually charging taxpayers per parcel presently. So that's going to upset that too. So do you have a way to reimburse the taxpayer for the obvious disparity in the equation that's going to take place from this?
So are you talking about, consumers are able to receive their deposit back if they return it at a redemption center. If they recycle it in their bin, MRFs are receiving a percentage of that refund, which would continue to go towards the way that we pay counties and cities now through revenue share. Yeah.
Well, my fear is this will dismantle a really good system.
Representative Finke, and then just a reminder, the bill over.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and Representative. I just want to say how wonderful and proud I am to hear so many people who are so excited about recycling. I didn't know literally every interest was already meeting all of our recycling goals. I also love to hear all the concern about our carbon footprints and making sure that we are fighting the climate fight. Everyone seems to be highly committed to this, so that's really great to hear. Representative Jordan, all of that being said, we have a just enormous waste problem, and everybody can attest to the failure of recycling. Right, being seventh in the nation in a nation that is terrible at recycling is very little to be proud of, in my opinion. So how would this bill, just like yesterday, is this bill going to help us with our waste stream problem? And how is it going to help our health, all of the things that we heard yesterday? Are we still attacking the same problem?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. And this will also serve as my closing comments for the bill. Minnesota does have a waste problem, and what we do not recycle, we either put in a landfill or we burn. When we burn it, it goes into our air and into our lungs. When it goes into a landfill, that waste breaks down and goes into our soil and water, and the air and the water and the soil go into us. We are, according to Ball, only 55% of cans in Minnesota are recycled into new ones. And so all the rest are burned or put in landfills. And so we need to tackle that problem. This bill is a way to do it. This is a bill that is supported by consumer advocates, and it's supported by people who are actually doing this recycling and need to make sure that we're doing something about our health. I'll remind people about the statistic that I've been thinking about for the last 24 hours, that on average we consume a credit card's worth of plastic each week. That should be pretty sobering. I think finding microplastics in our blood, in semen, in cord blood, in breast milk should be something that concerns us all, as should the proliferation of waste and the growth that will be happening if we do nothing to stop it. This bill will do something to stop it and make sure that we are also supporting our small businesses who need these products. With that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to lay the bill over.
Representative Jordan renews her motion that House File 3200 as amended be laid over. The bill is laid over. A couple of announcements. because of precinct caucuses next Tuesday, we will not be meeting. The Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee will not meet on Tuesday, February 27th. And then for the agencies, so the committee has asked for some information about grants that have been authorized last spring in the omnibus bill, and we'd like that information. With that, we are adjourned.